Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the historic Tom Jackson Building on the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. This year, 2013, is the year of the Civil War's sesquicentennial. That's a fancy word for 150th anniversary. There are all sorts of commemorations planned in Tennessee and elsewhere. In the meantime, let's enjoy a discussion about a new book written by our guest, Dr. James B. Jones, Jr., a public historian on the staff of the Tennessee Historical Commission State Historic Preservation Office in Nashville, and a former teaching assistant here at MTSU. And the book is called Hidden History of Civil War Tennessee, published by the History Press out of Charleston, South Carolina. You might not think there's anything left to be said about the Civil War, especially in this neck of the woods, but you'd be wrong. And we'll uncover the hidden history following these blue and gray words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU was recognized November 11th in the Military Times Best for Vets Colleges 2014 rankings. Military Times says it placed a new emphasis on academic rigor this year when conducting and scoring the fourth annual survey, a 150-question analysis of a school's complete offerings for veterans. Ron Malone, Assistant Vice President for Events and Transportation, was recognized November 13th with the President's Silver Column Award. The honor goes to employees that President McPhee believes go above and beyond the call of duty. And an MTSU employee has been recognized for outstanding service. Deborah Hall, an executive aide in MTSU's Department of Recording Industry, is the recipient of the university's second quarterly Secretarial Clerical Award for the 2013-14 academic year. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com.
Dr. Jones, thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me here.
What, pray tell, are committees of safety and vigilance? Because that was the subject of your first chapter in this book.
Well, they were essentially vigilance committees with the power of law taken into their own hands, much to the chagrin. I wouldn't even say chagrin, much to the... Well, they just took power into their own hands.
They were vigilantes.
Yes, exactly. And even though there were laws and elected officials, they took the law into their own hands. And they were frightened of Yankees, abolitionists. And if they thought you were an abolitionist or a Yankee, they would do terrible things to you.
Are these analogous to the white citizens' councils of the 20th century?
That's an interesting analogy. Perhaps so, but I don't think the white citizens' council would tie you up and whip you.
They did not operate under what you might call color of authority, in other words.
That's right. That's right.
How did they find out, or how did they attempt to determine who was an undercover Yankee and who wasn't an undercover Yankee?
Yeah, I think it was more an abolitionist than a Yankee.
Okay.
Because they were driven by racial fear, obviously. How did they uncover them? It was simple. Someone would say, I think the people in Illinois are really great. Well, you must be an abolitionist. Or they would say, I'm leaving now for a trip to Philadelphia. Well, you must be an abolitionist. It was just that simple. Anyone who offered a word of discontent about the Southern Confederacy must have been an abolitionist. And so it was just that simple.
Where in Tennessee did these committees operate?
Well, they operated in all the largest cities. Documentation that I have is for Memphis and Nashville mostly, and I have seen documentation for Chattanooga and Knoxville as well. However, the major centers were Nashville and Memphis.
Were there people who would go out of their way to display the Confederate battle flag and to talk up the Confederacy just to avoid being suspected of being a closet abolitionist, even though they might have been
That's funny.
Even though they might have been kind of milquetoast on the whole subject.
Yeah, there were people that were even Northerners who were even more Southern than Southerners in their wish to be to ingratiate themselves to the leaders of these Memphis. Again, it's one of the centers to the anti-abolitionist cause. They would ingratiate themselves, and they would whip people, and they would act as spies to ferret out all the abolitionists.
And it was based totally on gossip, nothing,
nothing,
no factual evidence of any kind.
No. And even if it was factual evidence, it wasn't according to law. It was according to the whims of the Vigilance Committee or the safety of the Committee of Safety. The name sort of varied back and forth.
Now, the conventional wisdom is that East Tennessee tended more toward the Union, whereas West and Middle Tennessee tended more toward the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So were East Tennesseans who dared to venture into West and Middle Tennessee immediately suspect by nature of the fact that they were from East Tennessee?
No, not immediately. I think people in East Tennessee did their best to ferret out any abolitionists as well. They were not kind to those Unionists in East Tennessee and did their very best and a pretty good job, too, of getting rid of the abolitionists. They burned their houses and or give them railroad tickets out of town and told them not to come back. And I don't know, maybe they were more humane, but I don't think so.
So there were committees of this kind in Knoxville and Bristol and Johnson City?
Yes, definitely there would have to have been. It was kind of a popular movement. They even had a kind of a network of a most informal, an informal kind, I should say. And when it came time for the vote for approving secession in June of 1861, they had sent out pamphlets ahead of time suggesting, and the suggestion was taken up, that they write the person's name on the ballot, and then they could count who was for the Union, or obviously an abolitionist, or who was for the Confederacy, obviously not an abolitionist. And so they could ferret out them this way. Many people just wouldn't vote, knowing that they would be criticized in this manner.
We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. James B. Jones, Jr., public historian on the staff of the Tennessee Historical Commission, and former teaching assistant here at MTSU, about his new book, Hidden History of Civil War Tennessee. In all wars, there have been so-called camp followers, as it were, commonly called hookers, after a certain General Hooker. Mm. But what realistic precautions could people in the military actually take against venereal disease before the advent of penicillin?
Well, not only before the advent of penicillin, but before the advent of the germ theory.
Yes.
It wasn't known. There was no connection between germs, which they knew and called, I think they called them animalcules. and they thought that these diseases, any disease, was a result of these vapors that would rise from the earth of one kind or another, and that would give you disease. And it was very, very strange, but that's what they thought. It goes back to medieval times. In any event, there was very little that they could do, but the prevalence of venereal disease in Nashville and in Memphis was particularly strong, and at least it was strong enough for the Union commanders to be concerned with it, and they made sure that the medical corps was aware of it as well and tried to do something about it. What they ended up doing was, in Nashville at least, and also Memphis sort of followed their lead, was to first of all round up all the prostitutes and put them on a steamboat and send them up north to Louisville. And as it turned out, the people in Louisville didn't want this particular cargo.
Of course not.
And they had to send them back to Nashville. And what can you do? So they established a license system of prostitution, where the prostitutes were inspected by the medical corps, given a license, a certificate, a license to practice the profession, and they would have to go in for medical checkups every week.
There are some people in Europe who advocate that that's the proper way to deal with prostitution today in the 21st century.
I think they do indeed do that.
Yes. Were they able to differentiate between different types of venereal diseases, between gonorrhea and chlamydia and syphilis?
Well, I know gonorrhea and syphilis were both mentioned. I don't know about any other diseases as such. I haven't seen any reference to them. In fact, they may not even have been known to be diseases at that time.
How were those who were infected treated?
Well, they were put isolated in hospitals, both the prostitutes, they had their own hospital, and the soldiers. Syphilis has, and gonorrhea, I believe, has three different stages. And the first is the most obvious one with pox. And when that goes away, there's not really much more you can say. There's nothing obvious about it, except at the third stage when you begin to lose your mind. And that could take anywhere from a year to 20 years. No one knows. I often wonder how many soldiers were infected and the third stage didn't show up until way after the war. And it's an interesting question, but there's no medical evidence. There's no study to show that.
So it is conceivable at any rate, even though we don't know for sure, that some soldiers could have been relieved of all of their externally visible physical symptoms, then released into the population and lost their minds somewhere thereafter.
Yes, you put it very well. Released, yes. I think that's the way to put it.
What a scary thought. And the very idea that shipping a bunch of prostitutes to Louisville would solve the problem of prostitution. There would simply be more young ladies to enter the profession to take their place.
Exactly. Exactly. Especially, it seems that prostitution and soldiers of occupation kind of go together. Because it flourished so, I wonder if there were fewer marriages or if it was just some sort of male machismo attitude. This is way after the war we're talking about now. But
of course, those who survived the war and who were infected were taking it home to their wives and
exactly
sweethearts.
Exactly right. And so you wonder again, if that's the case, how many children were born with it?
Was the enforcement of public health by a governmental entity, the whole concept that government needed to get involved in protecting the public health and spend money for it, was that a concept that had currency in an area that had seceded from the Union purportedly for the purpose of proving that less is more when it comes to government intervention?
No, they did not. The Confederate governments, or the governments that were under the Confederate government, the local governments, no, they didn't do anything about it. It was, the cities were, even up north, were just filthy. Just filthy. Even Memphis was considered to be filthier than New York. John C. Spence, a longtime Murfreesboro native, from his diary, and he talks about, well, this will tell you what he's talking about the state of public health. He says, they would drive the number of cattle, the Union Army, into town and then shoot them down. When butchered, it generally covered over half an acre of ground, the entrails, heads, and feet lying there. So in the course of time, several acres was covered in the way, and it began to get warmer. The smell became very offensive. We began to be apprehensive that it would cause sickness, those miasmas again. But as fortune would have it, the authorities took the matter into hand, dug pits, had the offensive offal collected and put up and thrown up and covered up. This caused the atmosphere to improve. Again, this is how they thought diseases were spread.
And I wonder how the concern for public health manifested itself when it came to digging graves to bury the dead.
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't know that was even a concern. There are reports of, for the example, the battlefield here at Murfreesboro, Stone River, where even 6 months to a year after the battle, the people might take a trip to see what was the battle like, and they would see arms protruding, dead horses still out in the former battlefield, and I don't think it was they weren't concerned with public health at all. Again, it was a matter of you bury your dead. Certainly, that's
right.
Kind of a Christian habit, Or so.
And they knew the dead would stink after a certain period of time.
Yes, they sure did. They sure did. And well, anyway, they would see things like this. Can you imagine walking past a mass grave and seeing arms with hands, skeletons poking out of graves?
It sounds like a Boris Karloff movie.
It does, indeed.
We'll have more in just a moment. Have one more break. We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The mission of the June Anderson Center for Women and Non-Traditional Students is to provide education, advocacy, direct services, outreach, and programming for the MTSU campus and surrounding community on gender-related issues. The center also assists older students who are trying to balance work, college, and family. It also sponsors a monthly legal clinic, career brown bag series, book club, and a newsletter twice a year. For all of the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
Our guest is Dr. James B. Jones, Jr., historian and author of Hidden History of Civil War Tennessee. This year, 2013, is the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. It's sesquicentennial. There is a chapter in the book about Colonel John M. Hughes of the 25th Tennessee Infantry. Mm-hmm. You call him the inadvertent Confederate guerrilla leader.
Right.
Was he an asset to the Confederacy or more of an uncontrollable rogue elephant?
Well, he was behind enemy lines. He had been sent back into the Cumberland Plateau by General Bragg to find deserters and to find conscripts for the Army of Tennessee about August 1863. And when he got there, he captured a couple, and then he noticed right away that General Buell's army had gone to Knoxville and just cut off his route of escape. He couldn't get past the army. So he had one or two things to do, just forget it or continue fighting. Now, he was in a regular army. He wasn't a guerrilla or a partisan ranger. And he decided he would take it upon himself to organize the guerrillas. And that's not saying that they were organized until he tried to organize them as a fighting force. And he would take them to places in Kentucky and places in Tennessee. And, well, he raised hell and carried the war to the Tennesseans and at times to people that were considered to be Unionists.
You might call it improvisational warfare.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Yes, that's very good.
Or maybe the first instance of asymmetrical warfare.
Asymmetrical warfare. Yeah, that would be interesting, too.
Where did he round up these people? Where did he get them?
Oh, well, from the existing population. There were guerrilla gangs already. Ferguson's people. There were lots of guerrilla gangs, and he would talk to them and get them to come over. And thing it was, he couldn't control them. They weren't army people, and he had a difficult time stopping them from burning houses and taking civilian property and taking civilian lives, because a regular army person does not do that.
He had no way of whipping them into shape under his command.
Keeping them in control, that was the most difficult part for him.
And how much were they able to accomplish?
Well, I would say that they at least made headlines in some of the newspapers, and certainly the Union forces knew about him. His escape finally was kind of interesting. He finally had found a time when he could not continue the fight, and the Union colonel, who was his adversary, Colonel Brownlow, I believe. He tricked him. He tricked him by saying that I'll surrender my entire force to you, but I have to do it on Wednesday because I'm feeling sick right now. and Brownlow bit, and he said okay, so he knew where Brownlow was, and he skedaddled between the Union Army and Brownlow and made it back to Georgia, where the Army of Tennessee was located at the time.
That wouldn't fly with most teachers as an excuse for not doing one's homework.
My dog ate it, yeah.
Yeah, my computer ate my homework.
My gorillas ate the homework, yeah.
Another one of your chapters is about a Union Brigadier General named James Negley, who staged the first raid in Tennessee.
I think it is the first raid. I haven't heard anything to precede it.
It was 1 month before Stones River, right?
Right.
Okay. This happened in 1862. So why did Stones River get more attention?
The raid itself, when you look at the size of the Battle of Stones River and the size of this raid, the Battle of Stones River would necessarily demand more attention. It was as raids go, it was small. Raids are small. Even the much revered Nathan Bedford Forrest coming through Murfreesboro was a relatively small force, and they thought that they would just show the Confederates that, hey, we're here and we can do this. They did do that. They thought they might give them a feint. As it turned out, the Confederates were so concerned about this raid where they came down in the valley of the Tennessee and fired a lot of cannon into the city of Chattanooga. The Confederate authorities thought that this was a major move, and it wasn't, just a feint. And so they moved troops away from the Cumberland Gap.
Okay.
The Cumberland Gap, where they had Fort watching that strategic point. And they moved soldiers away from it, thinking that this raid by Negley was a much larger force. And it made it easier then for the Union to take or retake.
How did you come across the information about Negley's raid?
Oh, Lord. I've been doing work on the Civil War since over about 20 years. And I found it in the official records of the War of the Rebellion, which is a 125-volume, four-series work of the official records. Most of them are, of course, Union records, because the Confederate records were destroyed even by the Confederates because they didn't want to be known as being war criminals or anything else that would implicate them to the new Union sources powers once the war was over. Anyway, that's where I got most of the information. Some of it came from old newspapers you could find on microfilm, and sometimes even from the archives such as the Metropolitan Nashville Davidson County archives. It had them in bound even, which was incredibly wonderful to look at. And microfilm of letters, collections of letters and diaries.
Were all of the things that you uncover and put into Hidden History of Civil War Tennessee things that you set out intentionally to try to learn more about, or were there things that you stumbled upon in the course of doing overall research about the Civil War?
I'd say the latter. It was sort of serendipitous. There are a great deal, many more tales to tell, but these were the things that stood out in my vision, or my research, I should say, as being easiest to explain and to write, to put into narrative. And it did. I had done some work publishing records of the official records and journals, diaries, things of that nature. And I thought that maybe that would be of some interest to the public. But no, it's not. It's what counts is a narrative. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. And so I thought that maybe I could make a contribution to the sesquicentennial by, well, writing something, providing a narrative under something of a different color.
Before we leave Negley's raid, is there any monument, plaque, or any other physical acknowledgement of it?
No.
Anywhere that you know of?
No.
No, nowhere.
Nowhere.
Zip, zero, zilch, nada.
That's right.
We'll take one more quick break, and we'll return with Dr. James Jones, Jr. on MTSU On the Record.
The Intercultural and Diversity Affairs Center helps to promote awareness and understanding of the wide variety of cultures represented at MTSU. The center provides information, referrals, and resources. Additionally, IDAC tries to make students from different cultures feel welcome and comfortable on campus so they can have every opportunity to fulfill their academic, social, and personal potential. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
Speaking about the evil William Tecumseh Sherman, we all know about his march to the sea, which left a considerable amount of Atlanta in ruins and paved the way for Vivian Leigh to win an Academy Award. Less is said about his occupation of Memphis. So how did that happen?
Well, it was again, simply just reading the records. And you come across a... Well, I did ask myself, when Sherman took control of Memphis, what happened? What do you do when you occupy a city? Well, you grab the waterworks and you make sure the communications are under your control. But what do you do about the police? What do you do about a population that just loathes you and is just absolutely willing to do everything it can to stop you, if it can? It just like little pinpricks against the elephant of authority, being the army. Well, what do you do? Well, he let civil courts do as they might, but the military commissions would take care of things that well, that the military thought were more important and not really the meat of civil courts. He used the army as policemen, which didn't work out as he had planned, because they were just too heavy-handed, I suppose. And he censored the press. He did all sorts of things. But what do you do? You've got an army in a city that's obviously hostile to you, and you have to occupy the city and keep it safe as a depot for supplies and whatnot down the river and down the railroads. And so what do? You just can't kill everybody. So you've got to make them feel a pinch somehow. And he did.
The book is called Hidden History of Civil War Tennessee by James B. Jones, Jr. It's from the History Press. You can always go to www.historypress.net. Thank you, Dr. Jones.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.